And welcome to Community Connections. As Greg just said, I'm Alan Collier, and it's my pleasure to be here with you for the next 2 hours. And this afternoon, we've got a person in that I haven't spoken to before, but we're going to find all about their group. And I've got Paula with me, and Paula is with the Mount Evelyn History Group. Welcome, Paula.
Thank you, Alan. Thank you for inviting me.
No good nodding your head. They can't hear it. Paula, first of all, I've got to ask, how long has this Mount Evelyn History Group been going?
Right. It's not a really easy question because we functioned for a while just as an informal group. Firstly, we were part of something called the Mount Evelyn Community Rag for 10 years, and we just wrote historical articles for that newsletter, and then we functioned as part of the Mount Evelyn Environment and Progress Association, MEPA, and we did that for quite a while because we were members of MEPA already, most of us, so we felt, why bother with a separate title and a separate... So we actually separated from MEPA in 2007 and incorporated separately, mainly because we were just getting bigger, we had things we wanted to do, and we really needed to meet separately.
And you weren't covering enough of what you wanted to do.
Yeah.
Paula, how long have you been involved with the group then?
Well, I guess you'd say I'm a founding person in everything.
Oh, right. So you've been around quite some time.
Yes.
So I've got to ask you before we get started... The group is called the Mount Evelyn History Group.
Yes.
Is that because it's different to a normal historical group or a historical society, or is it just that you picked that name?
Yeah. No, I think it is because it's different. It's more common to be something like Mount Evelyn Historical Society, yeah, or Mount Evelyn and District Historical Society. That's the more common term for people to choose. Because we began by writing articles for a newsletter, most of the people that were attracted were people who were very literate and who liked to read and write. Consequently, when we formed, we eventually made our incorporation aims things like researching and writing and supporting researching and writing in the community and encouraging.
So
we were a history group, we decided, rather than a society, which...
You know. So if I... do you have sort of like the historical societies where you have rooms and they're open a couple of days a week or something like that? Or?
Yeah, that's what we don't have.
Oh, you don't have? Right.
No, that's right. We do... We're really fortunate in having had a long-term partnership with the Mount Evelyn RSL. And they allow us to meet in their rooms, and they also allow us to store a lot of our paper records or even, you know, books and so on in their buildings. And that's been wonderful for us.
So do you have, like, times of the year when you'll have a display about a particular person or particular times?
We used to do that regularly, every October,
right,
when Mount Evelyn had an exhibition space. But right, Mount Evelyn has no place at the moment to display.
Not even the RSL?
Oh, well, in the RSL, but it's out of the way. It's in Birmingham Road, and you'd actually have to travel down there. I mean, a sort of central place where people would be going to look at an exhibition. So we do put them on when we're asked, and we will have one for the street party at the end of this year. But no, we don't do it regularly every year. It was good fun when we did.
So, I would have thought so. Paula, how do you decide as to who you're going to do an in-depth history on? Does somebody suggest to you, or to part of your group, or like how would we go? How do you decide as to who you're going to do a history on?
Well, all of the above, everything you mentioned. Right. We obviously have our pet topics and our pet interests.
Yep.
We are fortunate to have Janice Newton, who's Dr. Janice Newton, who many people will know, grew up in Mount Evelyn, and she interviews a lot of people and writes them up and then locates photographs and so on. And then we... So in that sense, we're trying to record the past history, the sort of thing, interview the oldest before they die,
before they push off.
But we have a very broad view of history as being just from yesterday. So we will also try and record...
Oh, so it doesn't have to be something...
No, it doesn't have to be. And, of course, we always include... the Woiwurrung speaking tribe, the group, and then under them the Wurundjeri that were in this area. So that's always, you know, high in our mind because they've been here for what, 30,000-35,000 years.
Yep.
And, you know, the recorded, but that's not what people generally, well, that's not the definition of history.
Yep.
History must be recorded with citation records.
Yep.
You don't say, the hill is blue, you say the hill is blue because on page 36 of that particular book we were told the hill is blue. Do you know what I mean?
Yep.
And we go for facts.
So when you do the history, is it mainly people or is it mainly events in history?
I don't think we're very strong on events. We're more strong on people and places, I would guess, yes.
Or it's a... Amongst what you've done so far, and I know this is probably a pretty hard question to answer straight away, what would be the oldest person, well, like going back how far so far have you gone back in history?
I've got most of my records recorded under date, so therefore I know where my records start. My records start in the late 1800s, and the oldest people we would be looking at always would be the first settlers, because they are recorded at the Public Records Office.
Yep. But and would you have always done that, or is that only in the last few years? Because it strikes me, as, and I'm not trying to tell you, but back in history, history didn't always worry about the Indigenous people, did they? Very often they did. So has it always been that you've gone right back there or is it just of recent years?
I think the main people that set up the history group were always interested in the Indigenous people because it's a fascinating... I mean, it's fascinating. It made Australia what it is.
Yeah. And so, it's a long while ago.
Yeah. I mean, it's fashionable now. You know, it's the sort of right thing to do.
And that's why I asked that question.
Yeah. But no, I think we've just always been fascinated. So one of our books is called Aborigines in the Yarra Valley and Northern Dandenongs, and that is our biggest seller.
Is it?
Yes, sell it everywhere. Barringer, used to sell it William Ricketts while it was open. You know, huge numbers. We make donations, I shouldn't say this actually, we make donations of that book to primary schools and so on if they approach us, but please don't all approach us, we haven't got that much
of print.
We'll have to reprint it. But the whole idea there was to try and gather up information and then make it available, particularly for primary and secondary teachers, so that they, because it was very difficult for them to locate, say, a place local to where their school is, which has recognisable history that they can, say, take a small excursion to. And that was our whole goal initially, but it's been wildly popular.
I was going to say, do you find that you do this with the schools, do you find that many of the schools actually take the young people out on excursions to those places?
I think excursions, this could just be a gut feeling, but I think excursions are less common nowadays. And for a lot of reasons... One main reason is things like insurance and and teachers are always overworked. I mean, I'm an ex-teacher, I guess. So, but they are always being asked to do everything, you know, teach people how to sing, how to drive, how to have morals, how to, you know, everything's always asked. So they're pretty pushed. And to try and get permissions from all the students and all the parents and all the thing and go out for an excursion is very difficult these days.
And, well, it's going to get worse because as of, I think it's about a month ago, anybody who goes on excursion that goes longer than the day, like sometimes they leave early and they get back late, then all the teachers have to either be given time in lieu or paid. And that started this year. So that's going to make it more difficult.
That's the kind of thing, but that's long overdue. Yeah. I mean, long
You're
overdue.
You're talking from the teacher.
I'm speaking as a teacher. I won't name the places I worked, but the number of times I was told, oh, you can take time in lieu. Oh, take time in lieu. Yeah, oh, take time in lieu. And I worked for tertiary institutions. Yep. I taught and trained primary and secondary teachers. Right. So it was, oh, take time in lieu. But when I tried to take time in lieu, it was like pulling teeth, you know.
Either that or you've had...
Oh, we must have you. You have to be present at this meeting. You know, we must have your input. And I'm sort of saying, but, you know, you said I could take a couple of days.
Or you have half a day that they owe you, and they come to you about 3:30 in the afternoon, about 2:00 in the afternoon, and say, oh, look, we owe you half a day. You can knock off now. So you cop 2 hours instead of a half a day.
Yeah, it's very funny. Yeah, no. I actually ended up, this is probably beside the point, but I ended up putting a calendar on my wall. And when my boss said I had time in lieu, I'd say, well, that's lovely. I think I'm going to make it December the 8th because there won't be any classes. And, you know, so there'll be this, that and the other. And I'd write... Day in lieu four.
Anyway, we're off the track.
Yes, we are off the track.
But it is, it's going to be fascinating. And some of these schools go for 3 and 4 day camps. Well, they're going to be, because the teacher's got to be paid for 24 hours if they're on duty at night.
Yes, absolutely. And you are on duty at night. I mean, a lot of difficult things happen at night when you're on school camps.
I bet they do.
And anyway. Of course, some parents go and then they need their working with children and all the tightened up children, working with children's policies are really important.
And that's good too.
Yeah, no, it's good.
But let's get back to the... If you say that you've got yours in a file and they're obviously the ones that you've done, how many various people would you have done stories or delved into their story with your group?
Oh, there's a combination of people and families. It's quite common for us to start with one person and then branch out and do the whole family.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
Because you're starting to collect information, so you collected about everybody.
Yep.
Plus, the other reason is that genealogy is really popular and, you know, and... the Eastern Regional Library, for example, has a person who deals specifically with assisting people with genealogy. And consequently, that's very popular with that family. and other people like to read about it too, so that they can see what they can do in their family. So a bit hard for me to answer, but I'm trying to think how many files would be, you know, it would have to be 300 or 500, something like
that. When I guess I'm only talking about you personally here because there's obviously more in your group that do these writing. Have you ever started off with somebody and found out things that you just didn't know? Or you've uncovered stuff that either didn't know or nobody else knew?
I think in general we uncover things that we didn't know, but as far as things other people didn't know... I don't know that we are that fortunate, you know, to discover. I thought your question was going to be things that weren't too salubrious. And,
that was going to be the next one.
Oh, okay. Well, that's more common.
Is it?
And that's what we have to make a decision each time.
Whether you print it or not.
There are a lot of murders. There are a lot of people just didn't become wicked last year. And we have to decide what we actually put into print.
I guess that's what I was alluding to, that you start off with... Well, I don't want to use any names because we're not going to do that. But we'll say a Greg Carrick, because Greg's here.
Well, I know him well, so...
And he's big enough and ugly enough for us to have a pick on him. But have you ever, say, somebody said, oh, look, let's look at Greg Carrick, and then you go down and you find out that maybe either he or one of his people were, in fact, a murderer. Like, have you come across any of that at all?
Yes. Yes, quite common actually.
Yeah.
One of the families, I'm going to talk about this one for two reasons.
Yep.
One is...
As long as we don't insult them.
Yeah, I'm not going to talk about Greg. The first reason is that this particular family lived on the land that I live on, so I researched it for that reason and found out about them. The other reason is that I've now met several of the descendants. One was living in South Africa, then I think it might be in Australian Capital Territory at the moment. But anyway, he has come down and we've met personally a couple of times. And he's a forensic scientist. And so he's very interested in that aspect of his family. And he's given us full permission to always talk about it. But that's relatively not that common. He says it makes his family more interesting to find out that they all, like, he had five great uncles who all died, I'm probably misremembering this, but around this, who all died, you know, quite different and tragic deaths before they turned about 30, you know, this kind of thing. And he maybe that encouraged him to start going to that line of work. But
So we've got listeners today, and if they say, look, I'd like to find out a bit more about anybody, how do they how do they first of all get hold of you, and secondly, how do they find out that you have, whether you've done a story on, we'll say, Greg Carrick or somebody like that?
We don't have a huge sense of responsibility of working for the public. No. I think historical societies do have more of a sense of that. We make it pretty clear always that we're a voluntary group who really please ourselves. So they would have to... but we would get that kind of inquiry. We'd probably get a dozen a year, if not more. And we really, really, really try to help them as much as we can without actually doing the work for them. If the work's already been done, we will probably know it exists and we can give them references. We'll give them parts of our books. We'll, you know, email them whole sections, all that kind of thing. We aren't in the business of making money. I know that sounds stupid. We're in the business of surviving. That is our income. Our income being greater than our exits. But we will donate things. We will donate our works quite cheerfully. You know, as long as we can afford it, and it's a good. So I've lost the track of what I'm answering.
Well, let me just ask.
How do they find us? Well, we do have a website, and strangely enough, it's not our own website. It's run by Greg Carrick's daughter, Joy.
So what's that website?
And that's MountEvelyn. So Mount Evelyn with a hyphen and then .net. Now, most people are used to .com, so it's mount-evelyn.net. Joy runs that. It's a community website. I think Greg possibly had a hand in it when it was set up. And they have a community bit on that, and they allow us to have our...
So if somebody wanted to contact you and ask, have you done a story on Joe Bloggs, that's how they'd contact you.
Yes. I think the most common way these days is people just type into Google, Mount Evelyn, and what comes up is our Facebook page, and they'll, or the Mount Evelyn site, and they will email us or locate our Facebook page and leave a message. And then that's how, the way we get them.
All right, so I'm just a bit intrigued. You're doing all this work on all these people, we'll say 500, 600, whatever it might be. Eventually, where are they going to go? Because as your group maybe gets older or something, is there anywhere that this will always be available? Or if the group was to die out in 10 years' time, does all that work just disappear?
Yes, it's a good question. It's certainly one we think about, one we haven't solved at the moment. There are lots of different solutions suggested across, so I'll mention a couple of them if I don't forget them. But the first thing we try to do is we put out a quarterly newsletter. So we record the information we have, and we always use the citations of where the information came from, so that people, when they're reading it, can be sent to the originals, and then they can go and look at the originals and see if we've distorted what that original document said or what, you know. And that is... Our newsletter has about 12 pages usually, comes out four times a year, collected by State Library and National Library, is quite, I say it myself, what should an author, but is very well respected as And that is, we get people from all overseas just typing in Google and looking for their family surname and finding that we've written about their family surname and they had a missing person who went to Australia, you know, that kind of thing.
Because there is a lot of
interest. We do get that.
What you were saying about ancestry before, is there's a real sort of, people want to know their roots, don't they? Rather than, say, my father's age group, they didn't care. Like, they were here today and, you know, they knew their grandparents, and other than that, they didn't care, and the rest. But there are a lot of people now who really want to know. And some of them, I guess, want to see what's in the family. Some, I guess, want to find out what the history of that family or that person is.
Mm. You're absolutely right. It's interesting you're talking about that other generation that didn't. I remember asking my father several things, and he would say, it's all water under the bridge.
Yeah.
It's all water under the bridge.
Yep.
Let's not talk about it. Yep. There weren't any particularly evil things in his family, but it was all water under the bridge.
Yep.
Nowadays, I think it's linked, sorry to pull it back to the Aboriginal society as well.
Yep.
They talk a lot when in their readings about country, and country being part of what they personally are.
Yep.
And I think this chasing down your roots and your origins is part of that feeling of trying to understand the person you are, trying to understand who you are, what makes you. My father came from Ballarat, and I feel that Ballarat is my country. His mother came from Cornwall, and when I went to Cornwall, I felt like that was my country. Do you know what I mean? I felt like it was part of what made me. I've got a Chinese ancestry, so I've been to China 3 times, and I'm a member of the Chinese Museum, and I feel that makes me part of what I am. And I think that seems to me to be a universal sort of drive right across.
Yeah, I think I totally agree with that, because people seem to want to know what's in where their past is.
Mm-hmm.
Once upon a time, because let's be honest, a lot of Australians came out here as convicts, so not everybody wants to look back and say,
that's very fashionable now.
Yeah, I know, but it wasn't.
Some people pretend to be descendant of convicts because it's so classy.
But back in, say, my father's age group, they wouldn't want to know that. They wouldn't want to know that there was a criminal in the...
Well, I mentioned that my great-grandfather was Chinese, came out in the gold rush in about 1850 and never returned. Now, of his children, about half of them didn't want people to know they were part Chinese, and the other half were fine. Luckily, my grandfather was in the part that was fine, but it's because he was wealthy. Because he was wealthy, he was able to join up for World War One, join up for World War Two. Because he was wealthy, people didn't sort of bat an eyelid.
But if he'd
been a lot poorer, then the White Australia policy wouldn't have allowed him to have even joined up. You know, I mean, what used to happen was it was left up to the local doctor in the district, generally, to make the decision. And if he thought the person had a high calibre, he would just say yes.
It probably depended on how urgent they were for troops as well.
Well, they wouldn't let him, because of being half Chinese, this is my grandfather, half Chinese, they wouldn't let him be anywhere connected to anybody that might be Japanese in World War Two. Do you know, they had to keep him apart because they were a bit worried that somebody might...
But not be too happy.
Yeah.
Paul, look, it's been fascinating. I know you have to get away. We're already past our time. So thank you for coming in. And if anybody wants to get hold of you and find out more about it, are you ever looking for volunteers as well to help, or have you got enough of those?
Look, every group would be more successful, I guess, they would feel, if they had a lot more volunteers.
Yeah.
We have our core group of sort of history-type people, then we have a group further out of history people who don't do as much as the central group.
Yep.
And then we have a great many friends in Mount Evelyn who will always help us. So if we run an event, we have an ex-accountant, for example, who will always handle our money, come do our book sales. He doesn't actually research, but he's always, any event we have, that's, you know, all of this kind of thing. People, they just say, let me know if you need me for the roster, for the street party.
Yep.
You know, I never have a hardship filling 2 or 3 people for each slot because they spread out. But The thing about getting more people is that more people require a lot more care and attention on the part of the executive. It's not that we won't do that, it actually adds to your workload. Yep. So it's a fine balance between getting more people who actually contribute and do, and not just a whole lot of more people who, though you love them to death, you are actually having to keep them informed and tell them about stuff and remind them of things, you know. It's six of one, half dozen of the other. I can't really answer.
Right. So let's just wind it up. But the major thing is, though, that if anybody wants to find out more about it, if they go to Facebook and look up Mount...
M-O-U-N-T. Yep. We used to have an MT, Evelyn History Group, Facebook page, and we lost the ownership rights to it, unfortunately. It was just, don't ask, it will take 5 minutes for me to explain. It was all my fault. So I set up a separate one, M-O-U-N-T. So it's M-O-U-N-T, Evelyn.
Mount Evelyn History Group, or the other way you said that you could Google, what was that? What is MT?
Yeah, MT hyphen Evelyn, E-V-E-L-Y-N dot net. And you'll get eventually to, if you go to community and community, we're the first community person on that website.
Sounds true.
If they wish to volunteer, can I put in a plug for the Lilydale and District Historical Society, which runs, which has a small museum attached to their rooms, which is the courthouse, and they can, and they're set up to train volunteers and use volunteers, and I'm a member of that too, and it's really great fun. But, if you want to volunteer, and I'm not saying don't come to us, I'm just saying they will really welcome you with open arms.
All right, Paul, thank you for your time, and we'll be back with more. You're listening to Yarra Valley FM 99.1, the voice of the valley, where it's 26 minutes to one.